Hi, Amanda. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. So Amanda runs a business called Thriving with Neurodiversity, and she's got a fantastic story and she's got some great insights to help people to thrive and workplaces thrive as well. So Amanda, thank you for joining us today and give us a little bit of an introduction about yourself.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. All right, so a little bit of introduction about myself. I'm an ADHDer myself. I have two neurodivergent children, so I have large amounts of lived experience. And I'm incredibly passionate about, I've got a fidget toy, which is you're going to see pop up every now and then. I'm incredibly passionate about not just raising awareness, but understanding and acceptance of neurodivergent brains, and especially in the workplace, which lag behind society quite a lot in regards to understanding of the unique different brain types that we have.
Absolutely. And I think that's something you and I probably connected, I think, online very early on. And I think you've been doing some great work on that. I mean, neurodiversity is one of those things, personal advocate area. I'm also neurodiverse myself. I'm dyslexic and also ADHD, which anybody who knows me is probably just like, yes, we've always heard that. But I think one of the things about neurodiversity is I've seen that's been great is that things have changed. I mean, I started advocating for this because I knew as an HR person I was hiding my neurodiversity and I couldn't be honest. I knew I had staff members who would come to me and say, oh, yeah, I just, you know, told the leader I was ADHD. And they're like, oh, well, everybody's a little bit ADHD. And it's sort of what that feeling is, and then understanding that the workplaces weren't designed, having worked for workplace designers, that in mind, and then having understood that the way that people interact and think about it, that for years as somebody with neurodiversity or a disability, as it was known, with a learning disability for many years as somebody who's dyslexic, you would always be asked this question, do you have a disability? And of course you would say no, because you're like, well, can't physically see it. So why would I disclose this to you that I can't spell for shite?
Yeah.
You know, how much can I get away from it?
An interview, is it? Yeah.
And I think it's great that in the last, you know, I know I've been advocating in our industry for the last 3 years, how much it's gone from something that needed to be talked about. It was never something in the DEI space that was there, that's something that is now coming out.
Yeah.
But I think we're also on a very big scale of where people are going to be, it's changing, but there's still a very much a lack of understanding. We have a lot of people now being diagnosed a lot later. So, for example, myself, I never would have thought to be diagnosed for ADHD.
Yeah.
My partner and anybody who lives with me or has neurodiverse people is like, I think you should go and get I can concentrate. Yeah, I like to be in varied environments. Working in the built environment is great because there's always 100 things happening at once. There's always things, you know, going to be. And that's also when we look at personality types, there's things that people generally, but it's the way that your brain processes. And if somebody's just gone through a test and sat there for 20 minutes, the most boring thing ever, and the site pretty much go, oh my God, that was very entertaining to watch you pretty much jump around 20 minutes because this is a boring task. It's very interesting that we're going to see, I believe, more and more people getting diagnosed in a later stage.
Yep.
But there is that part of acceptance. So would you mind sharing a bit of your story and how you sort of got diagnosed? And I can do the same, and that might help people to sort of understand and that period of accepting and understanding yourself as well.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Okay. So my daughter was diagnosed in grade two. Now, we were incredibly lucky to have a very switched-on teacher who knew something wasn't quite right. So within 2 weeks of teaching our daughter, she said, I don't usually do this with parents, but there's either something wrong with her hearing or she's not processing things right, or and she's already started to self-select as such, and she'd sit up the front because she saw it as not being able to hear. So she was always actually had already started doing that. So we got sight tests, hearing tests done. If I was a bit more with it at the time and had read the hearing tests properly, I would have seen one of the final comments from the tester was very hard to test. I think she was six or seven or eight. Very hard to test my daughter because she could not sit still long enough to complete most of the tests. So, yeah, that was a big signal there. And then we So then we took her to a specialist, and she was diagnosed with inattentive ADHD. She's both types, but that was more predominant at the time. And we had no idea what it meant. We were still in that world of hyperactive little boys, knew nothing about the inattentive. And of course, you're sent on your way, and here's a script if you want it, and see you in 6 months type thing. So I just started a deep dive, and I found it fascinating because I had gotten to, by the stage, I was around early to mid 40s, and I'd never been able to understand myself. I was the type of person that could do, you know, those personality tests or things along those lines. And depending on the time of day, I could come out with two completely different, am I introvert? Am I extrovert? Well, it depends. I don't know. I'll do it 3 hours later and I'd be an introvert again. And it's just, there's no understanding. I just knew I was different, didn't know why, how, but I just knew. So of course, the more I read about her and the more I deep dived into it, I just kind of went, oh, all these like tick box moments. And so, yeah, 18 months after my daughter, I got diagnosed with ADHD and anxiety, because by then I was just, I think I was 45, 46. So by then I was just this wreck of not being able to cope with anything because all the scaffolding that I'd put up over the years had just started to wear thin and wear out and just,
you don't mind me asking, because everybody would be at different stages, what were some of those scaffolds or those things that you used to mask?
It's just more kind of getting by, right? So it was more of an acceptance thing. And so, like, there was 1 year where I had our car insured twice with two different insurance companies. And then there was another year where I'd gotten to the process of getting a quote, and I hadn't pressed accept. So we had a car that was uninsured for 12 months, right? So it was just kind of, as you get older and there's more responsibilities, and especially if you've got children who are neurodivergent and there's so much more organizing and you have to be across things. And, you know, I'd go to the doctor and get my son his eczema cream and then kind of forget, you know, it was one that was just for eyelids and I'd put it all over his body because I could not pay attention. And I was just missing things. And life got to the point where it was just like everything was starting to crumble, you know, because there's only so much I could kind of hold up and juggle. And if I got something wrong, that's fine, I'll fix it. So everything took two or three times more energy and time than it should have. So then there was also my own undiagnosed and just 40 odd years of knowing I was different, no self-confidence whatsoever, no understanding of who I was. And my brain just went, okay, you've had enough. It just kind of stopped.
I think that's an interesting thing, because I think as another lived experience, I mean, I was diagnosed with dyslexia in year two. Mm-hmm. And if you meet my dad, it's 100%. He can't even concentrate in a movie. It's nuts, right? And I said to him last night, you know, our son's just, the teacher's pretty sure he's also dyslexic, which we know that if one parent is, or there is a family member who is neurodivergent, is highly likely, it is majority genetics you are going to have. And as I said to the psych, I mean, I think this is something that is just, you've got to remember, in the last 150 years of the Industrial Revolution, we've had to go to school and sit down in a room and do this. For millions, thousands of years, humans didn't exist like that. So actually being able to run around and do different things, there is always a positive. But when you sit at a computer and do something or be in an environment, it's like we work with lots of trades as well. And lots of people who run trade businesses or if work in the built environment, I believe are highly neurodiverse because you have to be, there's, you know, potentially lots going on. The ADHD thing and being diagnosed is because my partner works with two people who are diagnosed with ADHD, and he's like, when they're off their meds, and it's like, I just cannot deal with all of you. It's just too much. I've got just like too many people with ADHD around me. It's really, really hard, particularly as somebody who's not neurodiverse, who's more the implementer. Being surrounded by a bunch of visionaries who are like, great. Oh, let's do this. And I even noticed with my own team that I was like, look, I'm not being as systematic as you need me to be because, you know, I've been able to always be the person who started something and grown something, created something and thrived in high diversity environments. And now you sort of understand what that is. But get me to sit down and do something. I can do it. I don't love doing it. It's a bit like reading for me is, okay, you know, I'm just walking through water. But, you know, as we were talking about this book before, it's not an audible. So I can't, you know, I'll consume.
Yes.
I'll consume about 2 books a week because I'll listen to one 2.5 because I get bored if they don't move to the farm.
So I do my podcasts.
And the funny thing is, though, as somebody who does work at that speed, though, and is an introvert, I had to learn very quickly, and we had this conversation the other day, of how to stop myself and to actively listen because it's not my natural being. And watching my son now, it kills him if we make him say, excuse me, and wait to finish the conversation.
Because you can see the energy floating, like it's on the outside of his body. It's just.
And then he forgets because we've already moved on to the next thing, right? So and that's 100% me. And I think the thing is that, you know, it's notes, right? Always having an idea. So we had this conversation before of, you know, you're talking about when you were at school. And you were noticing that I went to a boarding school in a highly structured environment. I thrived in that environment because there was a box and a time to be there to buy something and focus time on that.
Yeah.
Take that structure away at university. And that was exceptionally difficult for me because I would create my own timetable if you must do this time. So it's interesting how those of us who I'm lucky because I already knew I was neurodiverse already. I knew I was different. I knew I was pulled out of school. I knew, you know, my mother had said to me, and, you know, and I'd been through the disability support at school and then at university and be part of that. But it's nice now that we're not labeling it with disability, right? And I know we're talking abilities. When we look at the personality profiles of and talks about in this book here, it's really good. It's Neurodiversity at Work, if anybody's listening. It talks about spiky personalities versus, you know, non-neurodiverse who have different strengths. And I think, see it, and I think that's Amanda. Tell us a bit about your own corporate life and I suppose the strengths of which you've found that that's brought in, but also then how has that helped you to be able to understand what this is for workplaces and people who are either recently diagnosed or coming into the workplace to actually work out how to, because you've got a very interesting background having worked in lots of different environments.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So I think I, as you get older, you do understand, of course, a lot more about yourself and where you prefer to work and the type of work you want to do. And so you just naturally kind of go down that path. I didn't have a career path as such, though. I think I called it a career adventure once because I just kind of bounced where the kind of ball took me or where the next contract came up. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't a deliberate plan because I couldn't, and I still struggle with it, planning ahead because it's the whole time blindness thing. It's really hard. Like I knew I wanted to study more, but I could never work out what I wanted to study because I just kept changing what I liked. And so, and, you know, these are some of the signs that when I look back before I was diagnosed that make a whole lot more sense. So I had like 2 lives as far as I see it, is that there was pre-diagnosis and post, right? Post came with it a massive new understanding of myself and my brain and also medication, which I take, I've taken since day one, so about 7 years, take it short acting 2 or 3 times a day and I would be lost without it, right? And then there was the pre-diagnosis phase. So I contracted quite a lot. I pick up anywhere from 3 months to 1 year contracts. I think the longest, I had a couple of permanent roles, but I think the longest I ever stayed in a role for about 20 odd plus years was 2.5 years. That was the longest I stayed in any role. Because even if it was a permanent role, it got to the point where I either got bored, it became too business as usual. I'd lost the dynamics of the comms and change and the big projects and all of that stuff that kind of kept me interested enough to do my job.
Yeah.
And or rejection sensitivity would kick in, but that could be another whole topic, another whole
talk about that. Let's touch on that a little bit later because I am interested on that. It's quite funny, and I mean, I feel bad because if people watch this, they'll sort of see me laughing, and it's just this sort of, as we said, I think our brains are quite similar. And
yes.
It's just like, I had the same, like constantly, and then wanting constant change. And no, I'm going to do this. No, 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 this. Always an underlying principle. The same thing. I was very fortunate that, you know, I was part of a business where we were growing. So that was a big part. It was implementing. Every job I've had is implement everything, create everything. And I think that's why we also find, and there was something the other day, and I believe this is true. I think you will find that most entrepreneurs or founders are actually neurodiverse. It doesn't mean that's the criteria, but I will think you will find, whilst it is general stats, about 20% of the population is potentially neurodiverse, I think that may increase.
Yes.
Because diagnosis is becoming a lot more open and people are understanding it, and there isn't this shame factor that there was, which is fantastic to see. I think there still is a bit. Like with mental health, I had this conversation with somebody.
Most definitely,
They were,
and
like,
the generation.
Yeah.
The generation you are as well plays a big
part. And that's it. You started out the conversation talking about how you were aware from school teachers. My advocacy came from, I had teacher friends and family members who were talking about neurodiversity and working with kids, and I'm sitting there as an HR person going, we're not doing and talking about this enough, and we're not considering it in the same way. And these kids are going to come through school and they're going to come into the workplace and it's just not going to be set up for them. They're not going to thrive. If we're talking about 1/5 of the population, this is ridiculous. When we know generally those people who are neurodiverse, and I knew when I was dyslexic, the first thing they also used to do was an intelligence test. Was to actually make sure
with dyslexia, there's such a link between, you can't read, you must be dumb. And these are the myths and stereotypes I also work really hard to break, because they're so destructive. But sorry, back to your point about.
Well, my point is they do that, and then they obviously go, you're highly intelligent. And then they go, but you can't read. So my point is that, you know, we are talking about highly intelligent, driven people. And we're having this conversation. When I was diagnosed the other day, the counselor or the psychologist was like, it's fascinating watching women who are later diagnosed who are highly driven and motivated and intelligent, and how they've managed to figure out systems and processes that help them to be able to achieve even where it is. But I think, in hearing your story as well, I think there is a point in life, and I think you have teenage children. I have children just finishing childcare, going into school, and that has been a massive transition. Particularly, somebody else has talking about neurodiverse children. You know, a lot of neurodiverse children don't cope with things like after school care or that. Or we know then hormones have a massive effect on.
Yes,
it's fantastic. Also being a woman, because we go through that twice. It's excellent. Where men do still too, but
I won't swear on your podcast. But when you mention hormones, my natural response is just
And that's the thing. And I think we should have that conversation a lot of people who have had children who aren't diagnosed with neurodiversity, when their children hit puberty, it comes out and they have enormous problems. Is that something that, you know, you can give us any insights into, particularly parents who might be going through that?
I had my kids later in life. So I had my daughter when I was 37 and my son when I was 39. And when my daughter was born, this is before we knew anything about being neurodivergent or anything, he'd worked out in his head that she'd hit puberty about the same time I'd hit perimenopause and menopause, and he half jokingly went, ho, 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 I'm going to move out. What I don't think either of us realised at the time was that the ADHD brain, hormones play around with the chemicals, especially the dopamine in ADHD brains, so badly that there's two key areas for women, and it is that puberty piece and it is perimenopause and menopause piece. And there is so little research done in perimenopause and menopause in general, let alone with neurodivergent women. But through surveys and asking for feedback from actually women in that situation, the common response is that that phase of life, so perimenopause and menopause, is when their ADHD symptoms are their worst, because there's so many changes going on in the body, and the brain chemicals of ADHD are just so susceptible to hormone changes it's like you need so many more structures. Or as I did myself, I increased my medication because your medication can become ineffective. And with younger women, because they know a lot more, they naturally start to look for PMDD as well, which is I'm never going to remember the full name, but it's just like PMT on steroids. So basically it, all those negative feelings or the emotional dysregulation, et cetera, is so extreme that every month, if you have PMDD, you can actually, there's suicide ideation. There can be self-harm increasing. It really, really hits. So, and 50% of neurodivergent teenage, female teenagers, some of the more recent research, but they think at least 50% of neurodivergent female teenagers have PMDD. So there's a freaking lot going on. So, and you know, there's just, it's women's stuff. And so there's so little research.
At least we can talk about it now, because we never used to talk about that
either. I know. But, I mean, I hit perimenopause and I didn't even realize, you know, that's how little I knew about it. And this was like 5-6 years ago, maybe longer.
Yeah. It's not as common. I mean, I had kids late too, and you know, find the same thing. I think people having their kids later in their later 30s, it's interesting. I don't have any research on this. This is only anecdotal, having much bigger hormonal disruptions, I would say, or changes happening, and premenopause happening. I have no facts on that. You'll have to go and do research, but it is something that is being seen. I personally am seeing a lot more of, and I think that's the really interesting thing with neurodiversity now and the hormone levels. I was asked it too, you know, are you going through it? And it's like, no, but I'm surrounded by that, so I know what that is. It's not something I'm personally going through, but it is something that we need to be aware of as well.
Let's come back to
a little bit more around, so I mean, you have a lot of lived experience in ADHD, autism, are the other areas? Can we talk a bit through neurodiversity in itself and some of the attributes if somebody is completely new to this?
So at a very high level, yes, 1 in 5 people are considered to be neurodivergent. So that's the, and there's a lot of neuro words, right? So it can get confusing. But neurodivergent.
Neurodivergent.
GENT on the end.
Yeah.
And that means, so 1 in 5 of us have brains that are wired differently enough that we could or have been diagnosed with one of the different neurodevelopmental or learning difficulties. So ADHD, autism, dyslexia, etc.
Which is another one. So just to give a bit of a summary, in ADHD in itself, you've talked about some categories. Do you want to give us a little bit about the different general types? I know you're not a psychologist or psychiatrist.
No, but
as somebody,
I have done actually just for since my daughter was diagnosed, as I said, about 8 years ago. I've dived into this so much, and I. Especially the research around it. So, and while the statistics constantly change, and it depends on the research technique, if a country's got enough money to do the research, if people care, blah, blah, blah. So stats go up and down, et cetera. But we do know that the diagnosis is increasing. With ADHD, there's the hyperactive type, hyperactive impulsive. So they're more of your traditional boys who can't sit still, make impulsive decisions, say things out loud, want to, you know, climb things. And I think I read somewhere abnormal amount of climbing. That's like one of the, I was like, okay, what's normal amount of climbing? And there's a lot of research at the moment to the prison system where evidence is showing that 50% of the male population is currently undiagnosed hyperactive impulsive ADHD.
I had
because very, very basic chemicals, right? Dopamine in the ADHD brain is unstable. So dopamine's that feel-good chemical. You do something, you get the hit, you go down, the hit goes down, then you just remember that thing gave you a good hit. In ADHD brains, it's unstable and naturally lower. So if you are hyperactive or impulsive ADHD, you will seek out rewards as such to get your dopamine up. And most of the time you don't even know you're doing it. You need dopamine to survive. It's part of the, again, the executive functioning working, all that kind of stuff. So your brain will seek it out. Like, so you don't suddenly go, oh, I need some dopamine. No, your brain will seek it out and it will give you the feelings that, okay, oh, maybe jumping off that roof into the pool is a good idea. And, you know, hence why, yes. So that's what they're saying, that close to 50% of the male population, they think, is in prisons at the moment, is undiagnosed, unmanaged, hyperactive ADHD.
Wow.
And then you got the inattentive type, which is a real misnomer, because it's not that we don't have attention, it's that we have too much of it. So once again, very interest-driven. If I wasn't on my medication right now, the dog barking, the birds outside, my cat purring, us talking, would all be fighting for equal rights in my brain, right? Until one of them did something that got my attention. It's just, you just can't filter it out. So the brain moves really fast. So it's not like inattentive. It's like it can be described by some experts as too much attention. So, yeah, that's just kind of, and there's so much more, they're so complex, and it's so much more than focus or hyperactivity, because ADHD is also responsible for emotional regulation, the executive functioning in your brain. So that's where you, like, adult, like, you plan, you organize, you turn up on time, right? And ADHD can really impact that. So it's, yeah, it's a lot more than people think.
So what have been some, I suppose, I mean, and we have focused here on ADHD, that's, you know, in other areas as well. So, you know, I'm dyslexic, which means that, you know, reading, of which my ass off, I've got a law degree, I obviously got better at it. It's not something I enjoy doing. But essentially then dyscalculia as well, which is, you know, not being able to, numbers can get switched around and things like
that. Yes, my daughter has dyscalculia, which is the numbers version of dyslexia in very simple terms. And actually, dyslexia is the most common different neurotype. I suppose about 1 in 10 people are dyslexic, not all diagnosed, nowhere near all being diagnosed. I think ADHD at the moment is about 1 in 20, and autism is about 1 in 35 to 40. But I think that's, they're changing all the time, and the numbers, as people, more people get diagnosed because of awareness and the understanding of genetics.
Yeah.
If you discover your child has ADHD or autism or even dyslexia, there's a very good chance one of the parents, or at least definitely one of the grandparents, will have it, because it is a very strong genetic.
Yeah. We have it on both sides in different things. So, it's,
yeah.
Which, you know, autism on one side, dyslexia, ADHD on the other. So,
yeah.
I've always had a strong feeling I was going to have neurodivergence. We will go through that process in itself, but I think it's something as a mother you always have a bit of an idea about. I think the thing is that we need to talk, and this is where you've got a very interesting background. So you've worked in corporate first, and then you actually went off and you studied a master's in positive psychology and strengths. So can we talk about that, because this is where you have this
thank you for calling it a master's interest. It was a postgrad certificate at Melbourne University. I was thinking of the master's, but it didn't go down that path. But I had, so to get a diagnosis, all right, let's start with the names. You know, there's deficits and disorders, and there's spectrums. And there's, if you have a kid that gets diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, which actually a lot of people don't like, they just like autism, or ADHD, and they actually ask what it means, you're opening them up to the fact that they think they're deficit or disordered. And the negativity, that negative medical narrative, is there for a very good reason, because you need to prove that these things are impacting your life enough so you can get the support at schools, you can get NDIS, all this kind of stuff, right? So they, that negative approach, because they are medical conditions and by law they are considered disabilities, you know, that's a place to start. But then it's so important to help people kind of see their strengths as well. And I, my focus is really strengths led. Everybody has strengths. And one of the things that when I, cause I do a lot of coaching. So one of the things I work with on my clients is always to do, I use a couple of strengths analysis tools, right? Always do one of these strengths analysis to find out what your strengths are, because it also finds out what you're not great at, right? So then you've got the little pile of what you're not great at. And you can then look at that pile and go, okay, some of that stuff in there is actually really important to what I do. So you can start to go, okay, can I get somebody else to support me with this? What structures or frameworks can I put in place? So I am awesome at planning. My follow through is ridiculously bad, right? So having that understanding about yourself and that level of knowledge about yourself, it's a hugely important part of acceptance. Because you have this scientifically tested research paper in front of you going, you're really good at this. These are things that help you get through your day. This is the stuff you're not as good at. And it's such an important part of acceptance, but also putting in those frameworks. But most importantly, it's also if you work on your strengths and use them and identify with them, the impact on your well-being and your engagement and productivity and all those things that businesses love, you know, all the research is there to show that there's such a strong link to leading with strengths. So that's what I work with all.
Well, and I think a really interesting thing is I know when I'm, you know, when I say I'm dyslexic, the first thing I say is, oh, Richard Branson is. And it's like, yes. And as we talk about, a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, are probably neurodiverse. Okay.
About 50%, yeah.
And I use diverse because I don't like divergent because it has a non-negative connotation. In my mind, it's different for everybody. And you think that's the thing you're going to find that with neurodiversity, there is general labels, right?
Yes.
But at the end of the day, every individual operates differently. And the hardest thing is that businesses just want a simple formula. This strengths-based approach is, from besides what you're talking about in coaching, is actually the best way of building a business anyway. If we take the labels out, so we talked about before that we have, you know, difference in spiky personalities. And I think I've been very fortunate. As much as I knew I couldn't spell, that meant that I knew I could talk very well and had very good auditory skills and I had the ability to articulate and always had that strength. So when I was shit at English, I would... I went off and I taught myself, I was like, right, I'm going to be debating and I'm going to be very good at that. Obviously, always a debater because I wasn't going to go in with structure. I was going to take the argument and argue what it is. But the same reason doing law degree, absolutely terrible. And I would have failed miserably because I can't spell anything, right?
Yeah.
But barrister, being able to talk, that's it. And it's quite funny how I've worked with leaders and they're like, so you've made an entire job out of talking. What that entire part is that with every deficit, it means that we get, like, if you take your blindness away, your hearing will get stronger. Yeah. If you have a weakness in one area. And I think that's the most important thing is, as an individual level, it's not going, I'm shit at this. It's like, don't put yourself in a box. Whether you are neurodiverse or not, find the things that inevitably make you shine and enable you to be best.
Yeah.
We can work on our deficits. And absolutely we have to fit into certain boxes and get, particularly earlier in our careers before we find where we're going to go. And that's why I'm interested in with your journey, you've found the same thing. But once we actually hit our strengths and once we get people in the right things that work with that strength, so that's understanding what does a business need in those strengths? What are the things that need to be done? Let's not put or let's not grab one person who is good at doing the accounts but is also good at doing the strategy. Not going to be the same person.
No.
That is inherently in job design in that we can create, depending on where your income levels are, we can create that within a structure of.
Mm.
But inevitably, when you look at any job description, it will say, these are what you need for the role, but these are the personality traits that we need. When we take a job brief, what is it that you, where are you at with your business? What do you need? What are the innate parts? And, I mean, it makes me very good as a recruiter in doing that because we understand the big concepts and particularly in working with business, being able to see that big part and work to minutia.
Yeah.
But for individuals, it also means that the hardest part is when you feel that you're a square peg in a round hole, that's when things get hard.
Yeah.
And that's where it feels hard. So that's where I think, you know, strengths-based is exceptionally important for individuals and certainly important for businesses as well. Mm. And instead of us looking at this neurodiversity of, oh, I've got this neurodiverse person, I think first as an organization, it's first of, well, actually, how amazing would it to have somebody who has these super strengths.
Yeah.
But what that might mean is that they're not going to be good at these things. So, you know, I'm fortunate having started a business, I can substitute my weaknesses by finding other people who are good at doing that stuff. But it means I have to be 20 times better at my strengths to be able to pay for those, right?
Yes.
In a workplace when you're offered a job, it's a lot harder when they're wanting that. And yes, there definitely is a part of knowing you always have to work on your weaknesses and not being like, oh, well, that's just me. You just have to take because we all work in a system. But being able to really know then if you can optimize and work to your strengths, if we think about it like a football team, you're not going to have the person who's the back. You know, somebody gets into a place, they work on their strengths, they become better and they're coached better in that and that team comes together. What's your personal philosophy on that?
Sorry, what was the actual question now? Because I was listening to you and I missed the actual question. But
that's awesome. You've worked in a lot of different industries. You've worked in change management and communication, and a lot of that is work to your strengths. You know, it's worked, as you said, in your career adventure. But obviously during that time, you would have seen a lot of different organisations and you've now taken this strengths-based approach. You now work with individuals and you work with workplaces.
Yeah.
How have you seen as the most optimal thing to enable both individuals to thrive but workplaces to thrive, to use those people and strengths?
Okay. So a couple of stats first. As we've already said, one in five people are neurodivergent. But you also have people like working mothers or fathers or somebody who's got stuff going on outside of work, et cetera. So other things like anxiety or depression or anything that affects brain functioning, whether permanent or temporarily, can impact somebody at work. So it's that what I focus on is the understanding I give people is that one in five neurodivergent, depending on the stats, between 50% and 70% will not tell you that they are neurodiverse. They will not disclose at the workplace for many reasons. A lot of it's stigma, discrimination, or they just don't know yet. They don't have a label. But so the key point I tell workplaces is every room you walk into, every meeting, every team, there will be someone who is neurodivergent, right? There could be people who are introverts. There could be people who are extroverts. So the key message is, we are everywhere. I'm making it sound really weird. So you manage your team or you manage your workplace based on neurodiversity, human diversity. So the one size fits all approach does not work. People who are neurodivergent have amazing strengths, like some of the typical ones associated with autism are pattern recognition, process, data. They see things in numbers other people don't. ADHD, it's, you know, creativity or innovation or energy, and dyslexia, it's like big picture thinking, 3D thinking, all that kind of stuff. It doesn't matter what strengths anybody has. If you do not give them an environment where they can thrive and a workplace where they can be themselves, then you won't see their strengths. So we start with offered labels and understanding, but when it boils down to it, it's how do you create a workplace that caters for human diversity? And so you can see people thrive. So you can see people understand and work to their strengths. And the new psychosocial hazard regulations that have come in across Australia now are a perfect place to start, because neuroinclusion can be the toolkit to help you implement the psychosocial regulations. And you know what I'm talking about. Basically, mental health at work is now the priority and concern and responsibility of all employers, and they must treat it with the same rigor and the same importance as physical health and safety. So it just, I get confused sometimes, because to me it just makes sense, right? Treat people like humans, treat them like they're different. It's not that hard. Right. And you've taken a big step towards having employees that will give you 100%, that can work to their strengths, that will stay around. Your turnover will reduce, your productivity will increase, all this kind of stuff. I get sometimes when I talk to people, I'm just like, hey, calm down. You know more than they do right now. It's okay. You've got to educate, you've got to, you know, bring people into the conversation.
So what are some tools that people can use? So obviously, yes, and it's fantastic. And again, I had that conversation with somebody the other day that, you know, workplaces need to be aware now that this is legislated. I think the hardest thing is, though, is a lot of workplaces don't know what that means. You know, it's always we can talk in practical terms, and we talk about understanding, you know, neurodiverse brains. This is understanding how human brains operate. We generally like to have three or four things on our thing that we can take. So if we're going to do training, generally there's only three or four messages max that we can have. If we're coaching something, that's as much. It's as much as we can digest. I find the same thing too. If we bring things down into frameworks and tools and techniques to be able to do, it's just practically, so it's it. But it isn't that easy. It is not just, oh, you do this box and it's it. No. But at the same time, I find that for people, it's like, you know, particularly leaders, we're living in a world where people are burnt out.
Yes.
You know, they wake up every morning and they look at their iPhone. So it's not only we're dealing with neurodiversity at the moment, we're dealing with a lot of anxiety and rewiring of brains from our daily habits that we do. And we are having a massive effect. And that is actually affecting people a lot. So we have you know, lots of things happening. And a lot of leaders, it's just another thing where it's, oh, God, what? Why can't it just be easy? Right?
You don't have to, okay, if assume that people think, interpret and process the world differently to yourself, right? So that's the first thing. It's just that realization that people think differently, so they have different strengths, etc. From a perspective of making something neuroinclusive, and for when we mean neuroinclusive, we mean inclusive for every brain, and it is every brain. It's not just, you know, if you focus on improving your communication and engagement, simplifying it, multimodal frequency, all that kind of stuff. Yes. People who are neurodivergent will love it, but so will everybody, right? So the tips and skills I kind of pass on are like, they're not a separate little spreadsheet or little checklist that you have to have next to you. It's a new way of working. Yeah. And that's kind of where my change in comms background comes in.
And that's that inclusive design part, right? Yeah. When, you know, we talk about the bell curve, right? If we design for these ends of the bell curve, then we'll increase the ability for it to make everything better for everybody else as well. But, and I think that is, at the end of the day, it is about understanding that different people, you know, I often say this, you can have 10 people in a room, and out of that room, 10, there will be 10 different perspectives.
Yeah, yeah. So it's there's three kind of principles. When people can get overwhelmed because people also don't want to get things wrong, etc. So there's kind of three principles I recommend that you kind of look at, which is clarity, flexibility, and predictability, right? So if you look at your communications or your processes or your induction plans, if you have clarity, which means you've used simple, plain language, you kept sentences short, you put in bullet points, you have catered for the different ways people absorb information, right? Flexibility in regards to choice of where people can work, right? So there's flexibility of, oh, yes, we'll have 2 days in the office and 3 days at home. But if you're forcing people to come into the office in the exact same days every week, that's not flexibility, because the ADHD or the neurodiverse brain will have really good days where you'll pump out 8 hours of work in 2 hours, and then you'll have other days where you need really quiet space, no distractions to get your work done, right? So there's flexibility in how people work, where they work, but also it's flexibility on, there's the goal that you want the person to achieve that week. Doesn't matter how they do it, as long as you get the output, right? But that can't and doesn't work in a lot of organizations because their tracking system and how they keep track of how people do work just aren't set up. They're just not mature enough. So you find that micromanagement and that kind of stuff comes from the fact that they feel like there's no way they can measure that output because they haven't really defined the output. So a lot of it, you know, comes back to processes and stuff as well. But I'm now talking too much, so stop. So there's clarity, There's flexibility and predictability. So if you have a team meeting, have it once a week, send out an agenda, make it really clear what's expected of people, send out actions and minutes at a certain time. If you want to catch up with your, if you want to catch up with a one of your employees or colleagues, you know, put a purpose, put an understanding, you know, it's, and that also comes down to the comms side as well. PowerPoints, don't go creative, you know. Every time you look at a different PowerPoint slide and there's a different whiz bang feature, that's more work your brain has to do to kind of take everything in. And so it's the three principles. It's clarity, flexibility, and predictability. And if you can, that's a really good place to start. And it doesn't rely, you don't need to know people's labels, and you don't need to know, you know, what's going on in their home life and who's stressed and who isn't. But those three kind of principles just make the workplace simpler for everybody and more inclusive.
Absolutely. I mean, you put in that, I mean, we know clarity and certainty is something, it's understanding of, you know, if we look at it on neuroscience and things that have come out, that is what stresses the brain, right, as well. So I think they're very similar attributes, you know, different slightly labels. I would agree with you on the flexibility. I think I predict that, and you're from Melbourne and I lived in Melbourne through COVID.
Yeah.
I predict that a lot of neurodiverse people actually thrive during COVID as much as there was a lot of anxiety, because it gave them an ability to have that flexibility more to work. Yeah. I mean, I work in a workplace, we have a remote first, right? But a lot of the people we work with want people in the office full time, and we'll support that. And the different reasons for those two, you've got to work out. And sometimes the hybrid way of work is actually the hardest, because people can't find that middle kind of rhythm as well.
And it depends on the role. Like if you're an IT specialist where you're going to be fixing people's computers and stuff, then there's a need for you to be in the office more as well. So there's lots of caveats to all of the principles type thing. But, you know, if you start with just that, and then you can kind of work other things out. But, yeah, it's...
And it is. So, I mean, I think at the end of the day, we are talking about inclusive design. If you design and understand that, in essence, 1/5 of your workforce is neurodiverse, but as you've tapped on, it is about diversity, right? Yeah. Is that every workplace is made up of individuals, and the way that each individual operates and is different. Okay, and we generally, even in doing personality tests and things like that, it's just about finding some generalization of this is sort of how this person operates. But if that person's had, you know, their mother's in hospital, or they're having horrible situations, their kids are going through a lot of stress and some horrible things,
that
they might bring that in. They might tell one or two people. That doesn't mean they have to tell, you know.
No,
and it's quite funny how a lot of executives are actually the ones who maybe having a lot going on, and they're just going to go in the next day and it will be okay. And internally they can be absolutely dying, or they're struggling the most out of anybody. And that's the reality that I think that we also need to be empathetic at all levels. As a leader who is neurodiverse, I think it's also important to be self-aware. And I think for leaders in it's important to be self-aware. So that strength space is also understanding that these are the things, and this is how I operate, and this is how I can work best. I think as you get later on in your career, you know, when you're starting earlier in your career, you kind of got to work to the processes of what it is. So even if you take an HR career, you start as an assistant or coordinator, it's all about that. But then to deal with the people part and doing that, and more of the strategy stuff, and somebody else is doing the administrative part. And so that changes, and what those strengths are needed changes. However, there is innate parts. And I always think that I think schools should do a lot more work around you and your personality and who you are versus, you know, I went and did a commerce and a law degree. Yeah, I love the commerce side. The law degree is, I love the interest of understanding and being able to get in. But I didn't really, the practicalities of what that would look like on a day-to-day basis would be different. Or people who are engineers that are in a very fortunate situation, they'll often start off in a very technical side of things, and then after about 5 to 10 years, they end up being in project management.
Yeah.
But again, the way that they may process and different people's personalities. And you and I obviously have been fortunate enough to work across a lot of different professions, a lot of different business types, small, large, different things. And we see these sort of trends and different strengths that take part. But at the same time, it is that part that at the end of the day, we are talking about people, but as a business owner, you are literally are thinking about productivity and what we're getting out.
Yeah.
There is massive advantages to sometimes changing the way you work or trying out different things and actually seeing whether that actually does work or doesn't work. And I think you've got a very simple framework as something for people to start with to be able to do that. Now, as imagined, we would talk for too long.
I know.
Little brain.
I've got, but I haven't said this and this and this and oh my God, there's so much to talk about.
Well, is there, just as we finish off, is there some, I'm going to finish off with a bit of a question for you around, you know, how people get involved and do that. But is there some things that you wanted to cover that we haven't covered today?
No. Oh, look, there's a lot, but they're all just like, they're flying around now and I'm not going to be able to capture the right one. But I think one of the, and this is one of my strengths, is curiosity. So one of the things I like to leave people with is just be curious, right? If someone's not doing something the way you want it done, okay, have you explained it properly? Do they have everything they need? If they do, okay, so where's the gap? You know, ask questions, you know, and open-ended questions about, you know, oh, I saw you did that a different way. Explain that to me because I thought that was really cool. Or, you know, you're struggling with a deadline. What can we put in place to help you? Or just, you know, it's just being curious. You hire people to do a particular role and they've gone through the process and it's recruitment is expensive. Every time someone leaves and comes back or whatever, it's expensive, right? So once you've got the person that has the set of skills, if they're not necessarily, I mean, there's many reasons why they might not be able to fulfill the role or whatever, but start with being curious. Just ask questions, find out why, and then work out, you know, with every single employee, you know, what, how can we work best together? Because everyone's different.
And that's the thing, right? So because there's two parts of how you have to think as an HR person. Right? There's getting every individual and getting the best out of them and knowing everything culturally is. Mm. And then there's the business side, which is essentially this is, in especially in professional service, this is your largest cost and resource. How are you going to get the best out of this? And we're all people and things happen. Conflicts, everything like that. That's why there's always something that's going on. and even if it's not the recruitment cost, it is literally you are paying somebody's salary. You are, you know, ideally you don't want them needing to take half of that time with personal leave or off or other things. How do we actually get and optimize the best out of that labor, right? How do we actually get take that business side out and put the personal people side in? How do we actually get the best out of that person? How do we let that person thrive? And that is where those things are. We help and we work with them and what they can improve. We help with them to understanding who they are and how they can be best. We understand, you know, and the adults and learning and motivation, where and what do you want to do? And as you said, yours was more of a career. I am a little bit the opposite. I have my entire life planned out to 80. You know, it's a rough plan that I keep coming back to, and it's generally a five-year type thing. So I'm not the typical. Again, very good at planning. Executing is definitely the minutiae is definitely where I have teams that help me to do that. But this is where I think it's important that, you know, if we think about if you're a business owner and you're looking at your team, it is literally – okay, I'm spending this money on salaries. This is this massive amount of cash flow that's going out of the business. I need to understand my people and get the best out of my people, right? Even if you're taking that downward below the line type thinking. If you're taking above the line thinking, how do I optimize and use all these amazing brains and these personalities in these people to help me to grow my business much beyond me? I mean, the best business owners that I love working with are the ones that say to me, I want to run a business that doesn't require me. They're the business. They get to flourish. They're flourishing. Their team's flourishing. And at the end of the day, every organization isn't, whilst I don't like the term human resources, you know, I've just said that business side is the resource side. The other side is the human side, right? Yeah. How do we use in a day where we've got AI and we can do all these amazing things with AI? The thing is, though, there's certain things that AI can't do. And it's how are we going to optimize the human beings that exist in our organizations to get the best. And funnily enough, I will be very interested to see with the emergence of technology and AI, as we talked about before, as somebody who's dyslexic, that was very, very difficult for me. A lot of other things coming through, whereas I watch my child who may be dyslexic as well, and their journey and their situation can be very different because I can type and talk to something today and it does most of it, whereas tech didn't exist to the same extent. So we are going to see, I think, also where the advantage of a neurodiverse brain where technology is that we often love new things and we want to learn new things and we often are exceptionally curious and want to bring those strengths. And harnessing and working to strengths these days, I think, will enable us to be able to build enormously amazing organizations because we can use things like tech to potentially to design support systems around where our weaknesses are to be able to enable that. So It is, in my brain, probably your brain, it is very simple, right? Because we probably see the big picture and how it all interlapes. But at the same time, we have two parts. We have communities, organizations where we all exist and have to learn how we all work with each other best. Not only that, we've got cultural parts. We've got, you know, there's a lot as individuals. We're not one thing. We're multidimensional. But we also then have those individuals need to understand their own strengths and who they are and how they work to their strengths. Yeah. And that's about our lives, right? I don't think anybody comes into this world or gets to a conscious point and goes, great, Lynette. I think we all want to optimize and have our best lives that we can have and want to achieve and be our best selves.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And it can be overwhelming for organizations, but just start simple. You don't need to, you know, your inclusion can be added to every single part of the employee life cycle, right? And that's just, you know, overwhelming. If you start individually with how you are and how you engage with others and how you see the people around you, that's, you know, that's the first point. That's, you know, that's where you start.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And then, you know, once you've got traction, then you can look at your processes and your systems and all that kind of thing. But unless you have the mentality and the culture and the willingness, then it doesn't matter what you do with the systems because, you know, I've spent enough years in change to know that it's got to start with the person.
Absolutely.
Supported by systems, et cetera. But it's got to start with people. So, and that's where
Amanda, how does everybody potentially work with you? How do they get in touch with you? What are some things that they can do to, I think you run workshops and other things.
Yes. So, okay. So I do a variety of things, but I focus on two kind of areas. So the first one is coaching. I'm an accredited ADHD coach, but I focus on like the neurodiverse brain. And I do personal coaching or I also do workplace coaching where I can do some co-coaching with a manager or an employee. Just I'm getting a lot of interest in that area and it's so refreshing to see because there's people that are like, we love this person. We want them to stay. How can we work with them better? And that person is, I love this company. I want to stay. And so it's they're putting in the effort and the time to actually do everything that we've just talked about. But if you're an organization that, you know, just doesn't know where to start, et cetera, then, you know, I do a 45-minute lunch and learn, which links your psychosocial regulation requirements and compliance needs with neuroinclusion. And it's like a toolkit. So it's just, it takes the complexity and scariness possibly away from both areas by going, okay, neuroinclusion is your toolkit to implement your psychosafety stuff. And then training workshops for people leaders, HR, health and safety, et cetera, just to understand the differences and then personally how they can start to make significant changes, which benefits themselves, the people around them. And, you know, Gen Z are the most neuro-aware generation. My two teenage kids, they know their labels, they know what they're good at, they know where they struggle. and they're open about it. So they attract like friends, like they've little, you know, nerd groups as such, as my son calls them. Not one of his mates said, we're all similar. We're a bunch of nerds. That's why we hang out. And they're super aware, and they know that the education system necessarily isn't built for them, and they're not going to put up with that for a lot longer. So they've got resilience, they've got bounce back, and they just, the world needs to kind of expand how they think about different brains and stuff, because they're going to expect it. You know, they're not going to work for a company that is going to make them struggle from day one. So, you know, it's kind of like you don't start to think in that way. And statistics and research show a lot more organizations are trying, especially in the UK. Well, I was about to say America, but I'm really not sure what's going on there at the moment. In the UK, there's a lot more workplace awareness. And it's just the way forward. It's just, if you want to hire the talent, then you have to understand the talent. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I think that is the great thing. And I think, you know, your kids are obviously more maybe in that Gen Z, or the next part, mine will be the next one after that. And
yeah,
I think that's where I look at it, and I look at what schools are doing. And even when I was looking at schools, neuroinclusion was a really big thing that was important, or inclusion was important. But it's setting people up for success. I mean, there's now schools that are hopefully still schools are very much centered around the industrial side of things. I mean, I think we're going to see a very different world of work in the next 40 years. And I think that's where workplaces really need to optimize onto that. I think it's interesting now with the influence of Gen Z's coming in, how much these principles you are talking about are actually going to be clarity, flexibility, and predictability. It's like, what do you want me to get done? Why do I need to work 8 hours just to sit at my desk? Like, can't I just, you just want an outcome. Give me that. I'll forget out the smartest way of doing it. That's what I love as an entrepreneur, because that's literally why I always advocate, don't hire somebody, because you're just hiring somebody to sit there and do that. You know, this is obviously for our HR. So it's like, we have a system and a process and we do that. But also as a consultant or external, it's like, and I have a lot of friends who are entrepreneurs, it's like, we're not selling time for money. What we're selling is outcomes. And that's that's the mindset, hopefully, that more and more people are having. And that is definitely going to be
focus on the outcome. Focus, you know, and that's for some older generations, and somewhere the awareness isn't there and stereotypes are still strong. Letting go, the change is a lot bigger for some people individually than others, of course. It tends to nature change.
But there's always dynamics within that, and what can people afford, what the parts are, what that sort of based is as well, and different ways of people doing. And then once, you know, productivity increases, then we only want, you know, just couldn't do it 4 hours, and we expect it done in 4 hours, so we'll do it. And that's
a big mindset shift.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, Amanda, it's been an absolute delight having you
on. Thank you.
We always finish off with a little bit of, is there any book, podcast, or anybody that you recommend people should follow besides yourself?
I have so many podcasts and stuff that I listen to, but I think one of my go-tos is attitude.mag, and they have a website and they have podcasts and they do so much research, which they explain in layman's terms, right? Their focus is on ADHD, but there's a lot more articles now about ADHD and autism, or ADHD and hormones, and just that, I think, when I was first diagnosed, that was just mind-blowing for me, just the way they explain things. It's simple, it's short, you can listen to it, you can read it, you can watch it, and it's, you know, it's perfect for the ADHD brain. So I think that's kind of my work. That's what I would recommend, especially for adults who were just recently diagnosed, or it was a real game changer.
Yeah, and it sounds bad.
I can tell you where not to go. Don't go to TikTok or Instagram, because unless you know the person, research does show that most of the time they get it wrong, or they simplify it, or it's just a, what I call it, social influencer. And, you know, so I always tell people, just go for the research and go for the reputable sites. Just you know, yeah. TikTok and Instagram's fun and there's some great people on there, but it's really a lot harder to sort the wheat from the chaff.
Well, and the ADHD brain would love social media with the dopamine.
Yeah, yeah, and you'll get lost and you'll be there for 2 hours and you've forgotten why you're there.
That's right. That was one of the first questions. Do you do social media? It's like, no, only for my business. It's not good for your brain. So absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, Amanda. And we'll include all of these notes in the show notes.
Okay. Thank you. It was awesome.